If you enjoy The Spectator's podcast, why not subscribe to the magazine as well? You can get 12 weeks of The Spectator for just £12, plus a free £20 John Lewis or Waitrose voucher if you go to spectator.co.uk/voucher. This is a podcast-only deal, and we hope you take us up on it.
Hello and welcome to Spectator Out Loud. Each week we choose some of our favourite pieces from the magazine and ask their writers to read them aloud. I'm Patrick Gibbons, and on this week's podcast, William Cash reveals the dark side of Hollywood assistants. Marcus Nevitt reviews Ronald Hutton's new book, Oliver Cromwell, Commander-in-Chief, saying that details that escape canonical accounts show Cromwell as being, well, deeply weird. Nina Power visits the Museum of Neoliberalism and asks how did society come to accept the excesses of capitalism. Christopher Howes provides his notes on matchboxes and says that he is not having a brat summer. And Olivia Potts concludes that there might be something to Americans' maximalist attitudes towards salad. Up first, William Cash.
A new stop has been added to the map of movie star homes and crime scenes on sale at LAX Airport. 18038 Blue Sail Drive, Pacific Palisades, the sleek single-story 6 million ocean view house where Friends actor Matthew Perry was found floating in his hot tub last October. His death has revealed something of the dark world of LA's celebrity staff. Last week it was reported that Perry's live-in assistant, Kenneth Iwamasa, injected his boss with ketamine before his death. While watching a movie around noon, the actor asked Iwamasa, part butler, part nurse and head of shopping, including meds and drugs, for his third jab of the day. He reportedly told Iwamasa, "Shoot me up with a big one." Perry was always a master of the sarcastic one-liner. Five people, including Iwamasa, two doctors, and LA's self-styled ketamine queen drug dealer, have all been charged with providing the drugs that killed him. Perry paid the two doctors around $55,000 in cash in the 2 months before his death. Questionable doctors and assistants have been part of the LA staff culture for years. Michael Jackson died in 2009 from acute propofol intoxication after digesting a cocktail of anti-anxiety drugs prescribed by his personal doctor, Conrad Murray. He was sentenced to 4 years in prison. Marilyn Monroe died from barbiturates despite her personal doctor instructing the housekeeper to watch her. John Belushi, who died in 1982, was injected with a speedball, cocaine and heroin, by a groupie at a party at the Chateau Marmont. Perry's assistant knew the risks. 5 years before his death, he was in a coma for 2 weeks but survived, alas, none the wiser. Dislocated from the rest of the USA by desert, mountains and freeways, LA has no centre. It can often be the loneliest and least romantic city in the world. That isolation seems to infect some residents. When I lived in LA in the 1990s, the most high-profile industry crash-and-burn drug death was that of producer Don Simpson, the son of strict Baptists and creator of Top Gun, Flashdance and Beverly Hills Cop. He was notorious for his cocaine-fueled sex parties and for being fired from Paramount in 1982 when he passed out during a studio meeting. Simpson was found on the bathroom floor of his Bel Air house, which he called the Embassy, age 52. LA police discovered 2,200 prescription pills stacked in alphabetical order in his bedroom closet. His personal doctor, who lived in his pool house, had died the previous year from an overdose of cocaine, Valium, venlafaxine and morphine. Nice doctor to have. I didn't know Simpson, but I knew his architect, Don Umamoto. He once told me that the reason Simpson had bought the house was that it was adjacent to the Hotel Bel Air so that he could order room service 24 hours a day. Many of LA's concierge class are afflicted by a room service mentality. Surrounded by a small army of paid assistants, people soon lose any sense of privacy or the old upstairs-downstairs distinction. Many of the wealthy residents of Hollywood I met preferred to eat with their assistants, from personal trainers to nannies. A dinner of Chinese chicken salad would be made by a personal chef, accompanied with a side dish of on-demand friendship. Simpson, like many Hollywood types, couldn't function without several assistants on hand 24 hours a day. Back in 1988, one former assistant, Monica Harmon, went so far as filing an emotional stress suit for $2.5 million against Paramount and Simpson. She claimed that he ordered her to clean up traces of cocaine and insulted her with a barrage of names, of which garbage brain was the most innocuous. Harmon's duties also included the task of keeping and maintaining a list of prostitutes, from which she was expected to book his diary appointments. The case was settled out of court. LA assistants are not Jeeves like butlers, personal valets, or paid lady companions in the Edwardian or Victorian sense. Nor are they like the young Yale graduate PA in The Devil Wears Prada, whose life becomes unbearable thanks to the demands of an editor who insists that the job is more important than boyfriends or family. The truth is that being an assistant in LA can bring great rewards. Many end up wielding enormous influence over their employers and revel in the power it brings. The salary of a high-end personal assistant can reach $250,000 a year, excluding bonuses. Often the relationship is codependent and volatile. The Hollywood assistant is an even stranger animal when you consider that many of their employers don't really work in any conventional sense. Even before the pandemic, LA was the capital of work from home. In celebrity bubbles like Perry's or the $12 million Montecito mansion of Meghan Markle and Prince Harry, there is no corporate governance, no HR, and no rules other than the demands of the employer. Last week, it was reported that the Sussex's latest chief of staff, whatever that entails, has quit after only 3 months, bringing the roll call of resignations to 18. California could be dangerously dysfunctional. The lousy, medicated LA parents of the 1980s and 90s were the ones who first had their children prescribed with drugs like Ritalin and Prozac. In the UK, antidepressant prescriptions for children has risen by 44% over the past decade, now at 500,000 a year. This trend of pushing medication all began with US doctors who realized how much they could profit from the anxieties of the rich and famous. One of Perry's doctors, Dr. Salvador Plasencia, sent a text message to a friend in San Diego who supplied the ketamine, saying, "I wonder how much this moron will pay." The sad truth is that for an addict like Perry, having his own high-end drug dealer was just another part of his ultimately fatal fame, like his chef, personal trainer, and pool cleaner. Service with a smile and a syringe.
That was William Cash, now Marcus Nevitt.
One of the most notorious episodes in The Siege of Drogheda, where more than 3,000 Irish people were killed by an English army headed by Oliver Cromwell, came when Cromwell and his troops chased a renegade band of the enemy up into the steeple of St. Peter's Church. When the fleeing detachment of soldiers refused to surrender, Cromwell ordered that the steeple be burned. We know that this is true because, in addition to the corroborating evidence, Cromwell wrote a 1,500-word letter about the event back to the House of Commons on the 17th of September 1649, exulting that he had even heard one of the trapped men screaming, "God damn me, God confound me, I burn, I burn." That telling, sadistic detail reveals much about both the writer and the addressee of the letter. Cromwell presumably only included it because he knew that his audience in Parliament would be impressed, and likely scared, by their Commander-in-Chief's ability to bring an enemy to a point of such terror that they felt damned, confounded, and abandoned by their God in the final moments of their lives. In letting the Commons hear the screams of his army's victims, Cromwell was knowingly playing upon a contemporary ethnic hatred of the Irish to reveal himself as a holy warrior doing a vengeful Protestant god's violent work, extirpating a neighbouring Roman Catholic threat. As terrible as those screams from St. Peter's Church sound, they are absent from the second instalment of Ronald Hutton's new biography of Cromwell. The first, covering his early life and Civil War career, was published in 2021. This isn't, it must be emphasised, because Hutton downplays the atrocities committed by Cromwellian armies during their 9-month Irish campaign. While he dismisses a once influential idea that Cromwell authorised a general massacre of the population of Drogheda as a nationalist partisan lie, his analysis of the techniques of brutalising violence committed by Cromwell's forces in places like Drogheda and Wexford is judicious, always conducted with the most expert grasp of the ethics and mechanics of early modern siege warfare. Rather, Hutton omits the screams because he largely paraphrases this famous letter rather than quoting much from it, remarking only that the defenders perished in the flames. This is absolutely characteristic of the use made of Cromwell's letters and speeches throughout his book. It's an odd and risky move for a Cromwell biographer to make, especially since the first two instalments of Hutton's study sandwich Oxford University Press's three-volume, 2,500-page Letters, Writings and Speeches of Oliver Cromwell, published in 2022 under the general editorship of John Morrill. There, the appeal, the craft and the deceptions of Cromwell's rhetoric throughout his career are laid bare in meticulous detail, helping to make sense of how this pious yet ruthless soldier politician persuaded and alienated so many of his contemporaries. We are, by contrast, distanced from the subject of this biography by Hutton's decision to precede his words so frequently. This is a real shame, since Hutton's Cromwell is already enigmatic enough. In this portion of his life, we see Cromwell emerge from the Civil War to become one of the judges at Charles I's trial, having disappeared when final arrangements for it were being made. He is rewarded so handsomely for his work as the highly skilled commander of parliamentary forces in the early years of the fledgling Commonwealth that this hammer of the Stuart monarchy soon acquired a property portfolio resembling that of the greatest aristocrats of the realm. The book closes with Cromwell dissolving the Rump Parliament in 1653, a body he'd done much to legitimise because it could no longer match his own reformist energy. While the standard portrait of Cromwell is an intensely religious man, even by the standards of religious ages here, and Hutton is excellent on how liberty of conscience for Protestants rather than radical constitutional concerns is Cromwell's lodestar, we also get details that escape canonical accounts and show him being instead, well, deeply weird. For instance, during the pressurised period leading up to the regicide, Cromwell ended a disagreement with the parliamentarian Edmund Ludlow about the future of monarchy by having a cushion fight with him. Similarly, when the signatures for Charles I's death warrant were being collected, Cromwell and the staunch Republican Henry Martin were seen horsing about with the ink, smearing it on each other's faces. Such oddities seem all the more baffling because we can't benchmark them against the very different version of his personality and inner life that Cromwell wanted to present to his contemporaries in his letters and speeches. Even if this book sometimes feels less a biography and more like a military history expertly focalised through the figure of Oliver Cromwell, the version of his subject that it finally presents is compellingly distinctive and one for our times. This is no Cromwell as liberal or socialist superhero as the late 19th century or the 1960s might have had him, but in his evangelism, militarism and republicanism, a forerunner for the American radical right.
That was Marcus Nevitt, now Nina Power.
What was neoliberalism? In its most recent iteration, we think of the market seeping into every minute corner of human existence. We think of privatisation, offshoring and the parcelling out of services to the highest bidder. Neoliberalism takes the proud liberal individual, in pursuit of his or her happiness, rather keen on freedom, and shreds him or her through a mean-spirited calculator to come up with some sort of shrunken market midget, an efficient risk-evaluating robot. Yet even though the market is supposed to be the arbiter of everything, repeated state intervention appears to be necessary to sustain this otherwise perfect economic vision. The banks that were too big to fail in the wake of the economic crisis of 2007-08 is an obvious example. As William Davies puts it in The Limits of Neoliberalism, what needs to be explained is how the economic critique of the state can be employed precisely so as to legitimate, empower and expand the state. Thus, our utilities are owned not by competent billionaires, but by other nations, Germany and France in particular. Faulty machines are believed over honest post office employees, and the working class are subject to the destruction of everything they value, so that the state can flog off every last asset. We might conclude then, as the Museum of Neoliberalism does, that neoliberalism is not a neutral economic vision designed to make the whole world shiny and convenient, but a political decision, or rather, a whole series of them. As curators Darren Cullen and Gavin Grinden put it in their introduction to the exhibition, neoliberalism is an obscure and extreme ideological cult of the 1970s, which rose to power and now continues to shape all of our lives in dramatic and often terrible ways. They make the point that these ideas were neither universal nor inevitable. The deeper question of whether neoliberalism continues to adequately describe our moment is also raised by this interesting, crowded, wordy display, which often switches tenses between exhibits, with wall labels often beginning with the phrase, "Neoliberalism was." This use of the past tense is a successful technique for creating an appropriate level of distance from the show's subject as abstract and hard to pin down. Ideology is the water we swim in. To present a history of the present, to make the now the subject of history by interning it in a museum, is already to crack the carapace of what we unthinkingly accept as normal. In this regard, the Museum of Neoliberalism is both effective and humorous. We can both imagine a future perfect in which neoliberalism will have ended, and at the same time we get a new perspective on the present that prompts critical reflection. The location of the gallery, which operates as a studio and perhaps even living quarters, is also ideally, if depressingly, matched to its topic. Next to a laundrette in a shopping centre scheduled for demolition, in a part of town that, like much of the country, has seen better days. The dereliction of South East London's 1960s Leagate shopping centre, its graffitied shutters and lone pedestrians, points to a world in which all human life has been reduced to its most minimal, fungible profitability. The style of the exhibition poses a tricky question of medium. Drawing on situationist ideas, the show, a tentative prototype for a much larger exhibition, uses many of the subversive techniques of de Tournemont, the overplaying, inversion and reversal of existing signs, symbols and objects in order to alienate the familiar. In this sense, the show harks back to the era of anti-globalisation protests of groups such as Space Hijackers and Adbusters and other forms of culture jamming that takes adverts, brands and corporate spaces and draws attention to the violent absurdity of our supposedly neutral reality. This type of cultural work reached its height in the early 2000s, but was a dominant presence throughout the 1990s, with parodic adverts drawing attention to poor working conditions and corporate logos redrawn to expose the reality of capitalist forces. This kind of humorous double take requires a pre-existing literacy with the controlling signs and symbols of the corporate class. It's not clear, however, that any of us still have the media literacy required to take subvertising and other parodic and ironic forms as meaningful critiques. The era of advertising depended on people having enough money to buy commodities, for one thing, and the internet has smashed our ability to read and see by barely allowing anyone enough time to step back and think, let alone critically reflect. De Tournemont presupposes, in fact, a high level of visual and critical facility that may well have faded. The use of irony, pastiche, parody, analogy, allegory and humour has in many places ceded to a new literalism in which the play of signs is no longer understood as an opportunity to work out what one thinks for oneself, but rather poses a danger. What if this cartoon frog is actually evil? How can we tell if this person making off-colour jokes is funny or not? It's very hard to remain calm if the culture is permanently inducing the fear that if you get it wrong, you'll lose your job and your friends will abandon you. In this sense, it is good to be reminded by the show of the near distance between us and these techniques. The Museum of Neoliberalism is, at its heart, deeply human and humane. It begins with the intuition that human beings are not machines. One chilling display contains a Motorola hand terminal from an Amazon fulfillment center that orders you around and tracks your efficiency. Yet this is a common feature of the gig economy and used not just by Amazon. It illustrates that the purpose of humanity is not to be dominated by the market, and that the purpose of life is not to be efficient. It points out that this obscure ideology isn't even borne out by its enforcers, because not only does it not make anything better for the vast majority, it doesn't even work on its own terms and depends upon the state for its fake independence from it. One of the most moving exhibits is a slice of wall from Grenfell that has the deadly cladding on one side, truly one of the most grotesque examples of neoliberal cost-cutting to have ever occurred in the UK, and the wallpaper from a family home on the other. In this sense, the exhibition makes clear the true meaning of cost when humanity itself is rendered just another node of the market and not the source of value itself. We perhaps don't know what comes after neoliberalism, whether we are in the zombie phase of the ideology or whether we have already moved on to something possibly even more devastating. But the Museum of Neoliberalism certainly helps us to understand how we got here. The Museum of Neoliberalism, Leagate Shopping Centre, Eltham Road, London, SE12, is open Thursday to Sunday until the 15th of September.
That was Nina Power. Next, Christopher Howes.
We've been told it will be a brat summer, characterised by its inventor, the singer Charlie XCX, as a pack of cigs, a Bic lighter, and a strappy white top with no bra. It hasn't worked out like that for me, so I was glad to discover a counterculture valuing matches over throwaway lighters. Young people, so the Wall Street Journal tells us, are collecting matchbooks and matchboxes and sharing their collecting habit on TikTok. I suppose it's better than swapping pictures of their burgers. Anyway, once things are collected, as anything can be, exclusive rules put half the world in the wrong. To the filuminists of the British Matchbox Label and Book Match Society, founded in 1945, a great crime is neighbouring a skillet. A skillet is the pre-printed rectangle of cardboard ready to be folded into a matchbox. A famous collector called Peter Neighbour thinned these by paring the back surface. Purists regard this as a fatal damage. I think there's little point collecting matchbooks run up now as a bait for collectors by a bar where smoking is illegal. Matchboxes belong to the two centuries that required a flame to light tobacco, candles, and fires. Just as cigarettes were decanted into cigarette cases, so in the 19th century, Vesta cases of silver or cheaper metal held non-safety matches made of wax-soaked cotton. It was shocking to me to read in Death Comes to Pemberley, P.D. James's whodunit set in 1803 in the world of Pride and Prejudice, a reference to Darcy lighting candles with the taper and matches to hand. Matches were invented in 1826, not in 1803. John Walker, a Stockton-on-Tees pharmacist, developed sulphuretted peroxide strikeables and sold his first metal box of matches on the 7th of April, 1827, to a fellow Stocktonian for a shilling. The British Matchbox Label and Book Match Society hopes to celebrate the bicentenary by making a film about Walker, if it manages to gain a grant from the National Lottery Heritage Fund. An early impetus for foreign collectors came on the 30th of June, 1892, when the Spanish government established a monopoly in match production. It sold Vestas in boxes with a hinged lid held shut by an ingenious piece of rubber band. The rough striker surface was at the short end, typically striped in red and gold, like the Spanish flag. Between the lid and the compartment full of matches were inserted little cards, fototipias, bearing photographs of actresses, painters, bullfighters, like later cigarette cards. Between 1897 and 1910, 3,175 different designs of fototipias were produced. The monopoly even printed cards on which collectors could mount them. One mount for the bullfighter series depicted a dead horse in the arena. In collecting, rarities arise unexpectedly. Norman Balon, the landlord of the Coach and Horses, when Geoffrey Bernard, the Spectator's lowlife columnist, used it as his office, had matchboxes printed, Norman Balon, London's rudest landlord, with the name of his most charming wife. On their divorce, he spent hours sitting at the table near the gents' lavatory, determinedly scraping her name off hundreds of them. Any left unscratched would now be a collector's item.
That was Christopher Howes. Finally, Olivia Potts.
The Americans are weird about salad. I'm sorry, but somebody had to say it. Really, their use of the word salad needs scare quotes around it. Where we generally mean green leaves and possibly a tomato if we're feeling adventurous, an American salad can mean anything from pistachio cream with glacé cherries to tuna in sweet jelly. It is a hangover from the middle of the last century when, in a perfect confluence, canned goods, especially otherwise unavailable fruit, and mass-produced gelatin simultaneously became easily available. The American housewife ran with it and, inexplicably, called it a salad. Listen, I know that language changes, taste changes, what and how we eat changes. But I still don't feel comfortable calling a combination of whipped cream, apple slices and chopped up Snickers bars a Snicker salad. And frankly, that's not even one of the worst offenders. There's Coca-Cola salad, which combines strawberry jelly, tinned pineapple, cherry pie filling and Coca-Cola. And it's not just the terminology, but the actual content of these dishes. Is it better or worse if the salad is in fact savoury? Perfection salad, a non-ironic name seemingly, contains olive, celery, often cabbage and carrot, and pineapple, all suspended in sweet lemon jelly. There are barbecue salads, which combine lemon jelly, again, with the components needed for barbecue sauce, all set in moulds and then placed on crisp greens with mayonnaise. I'll pass on that one. These dishes, particularly in the Midwest, where they are most beloved, pop up everywhere. They're not a novelty, but an integral part of a celebration. At the Thanksgiving table, a creamy, jelly-laden salad will often be rubbing shoulders with a beautifully roasted bird, mashed potato and stuffing. To those not indoctrinated, it seems bizarre. But this is also the country that gave us the Cobb salad, the Waldorf, the Caesar. So they must occasionally be doing something right. And actually, if you look at their more absurd, or frankly absurdist, salads, you can see glimmers of what makes their great salads so great. Salad for them does not simply mean a combination of leaves, tomato and cucumber, but so much more than that. It need not be bound by rules at all. Salad can be maximalist, with everything thrown at it. Bacon, anchovies, grapes, marshmallows. Okay, perhaps not the last one. I've begun to realise that this fearlessness in the face of mayonnaise is their strength, as well as their madness. And that's why I'm prepared to favour their egg salad over our egg mayonnaise. As a country, we love egg mayonnaise. It consistently takes the top spot, or hovers nearby, in both polls and buying habits of Britain's favourite sandwich filling. But it's not terribly inspiring. So what are the Americans doing differently when they make their egg salad? Because at first glance, it looks very similar to our egg mayo. Perhaps unsurprising, given that egg and mayonnaise still make up the vast majority of the mixture. But there's other stuff going on. It's thoughtful. There is celery, which is finely sliced for crunch. Tiny little pieces of chopped cornichons, which bring a pickly brightness as well as further texture. The sliced spring onions are softer, so harder to detect texturally, but their sweet allium flavour is unmistakable. The mayonnaise itself is given a punchy makeover with lemon juice, mustard and Worcestershire sauce, and the whole thing is darted through with the vibrant green of parsley. It is zippy and interesting, judiciously seasoned, balanced, and more comprehensive than our pale imitation. Does this mean I'm a convert to the more esoteric salads that America holds so dear? Not quite. I'm not going to be slinging mini marshmallows into my prawn cocktail anytime soon, but I'm prepared to concede that when it comes to egg salad, the Americans have got it right.
And that's everything for this week. For more articles, pick up a copy of The Spectator magazine or check out our website. If you've enjoyed this podcast, please do give us a follow to make sure you never miss an episode. I'm Patrick Gibbons, and I hope you join us again next week.